Democratic socialism, is it really the opposite of being pragmatic?
Socialists have always been at the forefront of the kinds of changes that now we take for granted. The 8-hour workday, the weekend, worker safety protections, social security, unemployment benefits. These are things that there was a world before them, and we live in a world after them. And we live in a world after them because, in part, because radicals dared to demand the impossible. And in every stage, they were always met with the same arguments, which is, well, your thing will hurt the people it's trying to help. It's impossible. You can't do it. And oftentimes, they did do it.
That's current affairs editor Nathan Robinson. We talk with him about his new book, Why You Should Be a Socialist, a primer on democratic socialism for those who are extremely skeptical of it. Then energy and conflict analyst Michael Clare tells us how the U.S. military will have to change in the face of the climate catastrophe. We talked to him about his article for The Nation magazine, When the Climate Replaces Our Forever Wars. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Socialism is making a comeback among millennials and the generation coming up behind them. More young people support socialism now than at any time since the labor movement of the 1920s. Democratic socialism, that is, which, despite the rumors, has nothing to do with Venezuela. But it's a little more than Denmark, too. What unites socialists above all, says my guest Nathan Robinson in his new book, Why You Should Be a Socialist, is solidarity with all those who struggle to get their needs met in an unequal economy and unjust society. Socialists, he says, demand the impossible and dare to dream it into reality. In Why You Should Be a Socialist, Nathan Robinson offers a primer on 21st century socialism, what it is, what it isn't, and why everyone should want to be a part of this exciting new chapter of American politics, or at least understand it before dismissing it out of hand. Nathan J. Robinson is a leading voice of millennial left politics. He's the editor of Current Affairs, a print magazine of political and cultural analysis, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the New Republic, the Nation, and elsewhere. In addition to Why You Should Be a Socialist, Robinson is the author of several books, including Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. We talked with him about that book in 2017. Well, Nathan Robinson, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's so nice to be back with you.
I just love this book, Why You Should Be a Socialist. It's charming, it's interesting, it's really fun to read. And you say it's a primer on democratic socialism for those who are extremely skeptical of it. Are those the only people that you've written the book for?
Well, no. Obviously, it's also for people who are not as skeptical. But I called it Why You Should Be a Socialist and not Why You Are a Socialist, because I was deliberately targeting people who don't subscribe to socialist beliefs already. Because, you know, I think a lot of times writing on the left and political writing more generally can sort of seem like it is for people who are already converted. And I'm very concerned to speak to people who don't agree with me, to address arguments that they might make and respond to things that they would say. So even though it's probably the case that most of the readers of this book will be left-leaning, I did, in writing it, try and think of the most skeptical reader. And I do that a lot with my writing because I like to write for as broad an audience as possible. And that really does involve thinking, well, what is the person who disagrees with me the most? What are they saying right now?
And you do really a terrific job of it, of answering all the questions, the tropes, the criticisms. First of all, I'd like to ask you to tell us what you mean by socialism. You also call it libertarian socialism, which is not a term I'd heard before.
Well, I like that term because in the United States, it kind of confuses people, but it's an illuminating kind of confusion because people think of those two things as contradictory, libertarianism and socialism, because libertarianism in the United States, now not in Europe, but in the United States, the word libertarian means sort of free market capitalist, and socialism's the opposite of that. But it's actually libertarian socialism has a long tradition. And one of the things that I am concerned with pointing out in this book is that socialism, that word, covers a very, very rich political tradition. And there are arguments within socialism about what it means. And one of the reasons that I think actually readers are going to be a little dissatisfied if they come in looking for like the clear answer to what socialism means is one thing I say is, well, there's a long argument that has gone on among socialists about what it means to call yourself that. So I kind of explore what that political tradition is and what I think those people have in common. And, I do define some of the things I feel like people in that tradition have in common, which is a very strong sense of outrage at grotesque inequality and also at the structure whereby some people own things and some people have to sell their labor, right? That's the original sort of economic foundation of socialism. But I point out that it kind of goes beyond that as well, and it captures this real feeling of solidarity with the underclass, that it's more than just an economic system. It's also kind of an ethic, and it's a way of looking at the world and a way of thinking about the world. And socialists have in common that they feel something very deep and very powerful, and they have been sort of fighting very hard, and they refuse to accept. It's also a utopian feeling because, and I write about utopias in the book, because it is a refusal to accept what is presented to you as the limits of what is possible. And there's an old anarchist slogan, which is demand the impossible. And I love that slogan. And I think that's what kind of socialists dare to do, is demand the supposedly impossible.
And there's also the slogan of another world is possible.
Yes, exactly. I mean, one of the things that socialists have always tried to convince people is that the things that they see around them in society are not fixed features of the world. History is a moving process. Things change, and things change in part because people commit themselves to changing them. You know, socialists have always been at the forefront of the kinds of changes that now we take for granted, right? The 8-hour workday, the weekend, worker safety protections, social security, unemployment benefits. These are things that there was a world before them, and we live in a world after them. And we live in a world after them because, in part, because radicals dared to demand the impossible. And in every stage, they were always met with the same arguments, which is, well, your thing will hurt the people it's trying to help. It's impossible. You can't do it. And oftentimes they did do it. And so the debate over free college that we're having today was once had over free public high schools. But today we accept free public high schools as a very normal thing, but we see free public colleges as this very radical utopian thing. And one of the things that I want to point out in this book is that in every era, the socialists are the ones who dare to imagine something new. They dare to imagine the next phase.
Free public college is actually not even new. My mother, who went to Brooklyn College in the 1940s, well, she went to Brooklyn College when it was free. In fact, the CUNY system was entirely free until the 1970s.
Well, yes. And I mean, of course, a lot of the things that socialists advocate have been tried around the world, right? And they're treated as absurd, even though we have actual examples of them working. I mean, this is why a lot of contemporary socialists point to Nordic social democratic programs and say, well, this thing that you think is ridiculous, actually, it happens. It's in the world that we live in today. And I think when you say, you know, public colleges, you know, we had them, I think that brings up something so important, which is that when things regress, oftentimes the next generation comes to accept those things as a fixed part of the world. Like, I mean, I always think about like pensions, for example, people not expecting pensions anymore in my generation and thinking that that's, oh, well, the idea that you'd get a pension is absurd. But it isn't absurd, right? And so one of the things that socialists try to do is raise people's expectations and say you have the right to expect more because we live in a very prosperous world. You know, so it's in part about giving people examples of things that have happened before or that happen elsewhere and saying, you know, you deserve this too.
Now, you brought up the term social democracy, and you make, I think, a very important and interesting point about the difference between socialism or socialists and social democrats. Why don't you tease that out for us?
Well, it's complicated because, again, people use words in different ways. So some people could use the term social democracy to refer to something that is not very radical at all. And some people could use it to refer to something, you know, the German Social Democratic Party of the early 20th century was a very socialist party. It was further to the left than what we think of, you know, Bernie Sanders as being or Roosevelt as being. So social democracy, it's used different ways, but the way I think is useful to think about it and why I think the phrase democratic socialism is important to embrace is that a lot of times when people say they advocate social democracy, it's a kind of signifier that they are distancing themselves from the more radical and utopian visions that have been associated with the socialist tradition. And the socialists have always been ones who imagine things multiple steps beyond where we are now. They look at the world and they not only think, well, we want Medicare for all, for example, but they also think, well, what would healthcare look like in the ideal world? They're often thinking of the ideal world. So, you know, today we might focus on expanding union membership, but tomorrow we'll be thinking about, well, really having workers own their workplaces and their companies, which has been one of the historic big demands of socialism, is that the people who do the work ought to receive the benefit. So the social democrat sort of doesn't have that same kind of long-term radical aspiration that people who have united under the banner of the word socialism have always, always had.
Yes, and I think you make, for example, a contrast. Sanders is often talked about as being an FDR, a social democrat. But FDR, as you point out in your book, Nathan Robinson, you point out in Why You Should Be a Socialist, that FDR was trying to protect capitalism from itself.
Yes. Which is also sort of the category that I put Elizabeth Warren in today. And, you know, that's the tradition that she and FDR operate. And socialism is something a little different because, you know, Bernie Sanders has always defined his hero has always been Eugene Debs, who is much more radical than Franklin Roosevelt. Eugene Debs criticized capitalism itself. So I take it that what Sanders' position is, and I think he would agree with this, is social democracy is a short-term aspiration. What we want right now is the New Deal. That is what is feasible. What we want right now is a Nordic social democracy because that is feasible. But that is not our end point. We don't end by, you know, regulating markets. We are trying to produce the good life for everybody on Earth, and we have a real serious long-term radical vision for what that is.
Now, before you mentioned the word utopianism, you talked about idealism. Socialists often get the complaint that they're not being pragmatic. You know, you hear from many of the centrist Democratic candidates, we're pragmatists, we get things done. And I wonder if you could address that so-called contradiction between idealism and pragmatism.
I think you have to be both. It is not enough merely to be a pragmatist. You have to be careful and you have to be sensible about policy and knowledgeable of policy. And I think this is what many contemporary socialists are, is they balance a kind of utopianism with pragmatism. And I think what often gets lost, and people who say, well, I get things done, is yes, but toward what ultimate end? Do you really have a vision for the good society? Sort of, if you look forward 100, 200 years into the future, what do you see the world as being like? What can human beings accomplish together if we really achieve our potential? Now, socialists have always been the ones who say, well, it would be a world without war, for example. There would be no wars. There would be no borders, because people should be able to pass freely between countries. There would be no prisons. Eugene Debs famously said, while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Which is an interesting thing when you think about it, to say that true freedom cannot be achieved for anyone until we eliminate prisons. I mean, it's a radical, radical position. Now, I happen to believe that's a long-term position. It doesn't seem like it would happen in the near future. But I think that really distinguishes socialists. I don't think any contemporary social democrat, I don't think FDR, I don't think Elizabeth Warren would have said, while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. That's quite extraordinary. But I think what we as socialists encourage people to do is to dream big. Now, there's the real caution that you have to have, because if you are just a dreamer and you don't look at the realities of the world around you and you start trying to reshape it, you know, people have pointed out that utopian thinking can lead to catastrophe, because it can be a denial of real world constraints on what you can do. But I also think it's important to recognize that the opposite is true as well, which is that if you have no vision, you're not going to go anywhere. And I think a lot of contemporary democratic politicians who are not socialists don't have that kind of aspiration. They don't. I ask people all the time who are sort of moderate, I go, you know, tell me about your utopia. And they say things like, well, you know, in my utopia, we'd reduce the unemployment rate by a few points. And it's like, you've got to dream bigger.
I'd like to push you a little bit harder, though, on this pragmatism versus utopianism idea, because mm-hmm. right now we live in a world which is in existential crisis. You live in New Orleans. You don't even want to think about climate, the climate catastrophe that is bearing down on us with ever greater sure. speed. So in a world in crisis, perhaps the only pragmatic solution is, in fact, the one that dreams big, the Green New Deal, the one that says we need to move to a world economy that in which profit is no longer the sole goal, because profit is destroying the planet.
Well, you know, Naomi Klein points out, I mean, she's not someone who is necessarily optimistic about the future of human civilization, right? I mean, her latest book is called On Fire. But she actually has been embracing this kind of utopian thinking. She and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Molly Crabapple produced a video imagining a very different future. It was, you know, AOC, you know, decades into the future, looking back at this amazing sort of green and sustainable society that we built together and how we averted the catastrophe. And I think one reason that it's actually very, very important to meet that kind of severe crisis with such a swing in the opposite direction is because one of the major dangers that kind of crisis has is that it engenders hopelessness. And hopelessness is suicidal. I mean, you see, I mean, I don't know if you saw Jonathan Franzen's article in The New Yorker a month or so ago, where he was talking about the climate apocalypse. And he basically goes, well, it's unavoidable. So we got to, I mean, resign ourselves to it and be nice to our neighbors. And that's a very dangerous attitude, because if you do it, you're really saying, you know, well, everything's just going to get worse. There's an expression that I really like, which is, I think it's from Frederick Jameson, which is, it's easier to imagine the end of the world these days than to imagine the end of capitalism. And so our task now is to imagine the end of capitalism, to really dare to think about what a different path would look like. Because unless you do that, people are not going to believe that it's possible. So I've actually had another book come out in the past month, which I'm giving away for free because it's just a fun one, which is a memoir that I wrote from the future, from the year 2076. And it's from the socialist utopia about sort of how the last several decades of human life went. And it's written by myself as an old man. And, you know, the reactions that I've gotten from people to read that have said, well, this is very inspiring and very helpful to me because what I needed right now is a feeling that a very different kind of future was possible. And I think that's one of the values that socialists have always given people is that they've given people this possibility, even if it's a remote possibility, even if we don't even know whether it's possible, this possibility of something very, very different and wonderful.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Nathan Robinson about his new book, Why You Should Be a Socialist. You spoke earlier about the outrage. Basically, if you're not angry at what's going on, you're not alive. But there's also another part, which is the compassion, the sense of solidarity. You know, I think of that absolutely electric moment, and I was there at the Bernie rally in Queens when he said, look at the person next to you and pledge to fight as hard for them as you will for yourself. I can tell you that that was where it really came home, that what he's talking about is a vision that is so simple and so human. After all, isn't that how we succeeded as human beings, is to look out for each other, not by killing each other?
Yeah, I think that is one of the most powerful moments of any speech that I've pretty much ever seen. It gives me chills to watch it, and I've cited it a few times because he really does very succinctly express what it means to have solidarity, which is not just I care about someone else, but it's interesting because, you know, Debs is Sanders' hero. And what he said there is a rearticulation of the same Debs phrase, which is that it's not about what happens to me. It's what happens to someone who's very different from me. You know, while there is a lower class, I am in it, is what Deb said. And what Sanders said was, you know, while there are people who are, you know, unauthorized immigrants who are being terrorized, your struggle and their struggle must be one and the same. You know, that is one of the things that I try to express not nearly as simply and articulately in this book. It's very beautiful. And also, it's not just beautiful, but it's a recipe for actually doing things. Because so there's this, you know, the famous example in economics, the prisoner's dilemma. And in the prisoner's dilemma, it's about two prisoners, one in one room, one in the other, and they're interviewed. And it's in each prisoner's interest to betray the other prisoner. But if they both kept silent, they would both have a lower sentence. But of course, in a selfish world where you look out for your own interest, both prisoners betray each other and they both end up with the longest possible sentence. And, you know, in economics, that's sort of used as an interesting economic puzzle. But what it actually is it's, to me, a parable about solidarity, right? Which is that if you hold together, you accomplish more than if you just look out for your own self-interest. If a union just looks out for its members and does not look out for the members of other unions, then those two unions will get less because they didn't work together and they didn't see each other's interests as being the same. And so what Bernie does is he says, let's take the racial justice fight, the economic justice fight, and let's not have the left tear itself apart. Let's not have schisms. Let's see that when we work together and we have those feelings of solidarity, we all can get what we want.
You also talk about the difference between policy and politics. I wasn't quite sure what you meant by that in this book, Why You Should Be a Socialist, Nathan Robinson, until you linked those things to power. And what I understand you mean by politics is power. So talk about the issue of power, how we get power for the people in reality, and the difference between that and policy.
Sure. So when I talk about politics versus policy, what I mean is the difference between the policies, the laws you make, You know, but Medicare for All is a policy. You can describe how it would work, what it would mean to have single-payer healthcare. There's a bill. Politics is how you get it. Politics is the process by which power is apportioned and the process by which decisions are made. And one very, very important lesson, I think, from the Obama administration is that it's not enough just to have a list of good policies. You can come up with the best policies, but there's a whole pre-policy part, which is the struggle over how you actually get enough power to implement your policies. And I don't think Barack Obama had a very good understanding of how politics works. And I mean that only because Barack Obama thought until the very last days of his presidency that he could get Republicans to work with him on things. But Republicans understand how political power works. And I like Bernie because he also understands how political power works. An interesting example of this is, so Bernie introduced a bill called the Stop Bezos Act, I think last year, and it was a bill that was designed to make Amazon pay for the government benefits that its workers receive. You know, if its workers on food stamps, Amazon would have to pay. And a bunch of policy wonks pointed out that this was a very bad policy. They said, what is Bernie doing? He's introducing this thing that would require, and you know, they calculated the economic effects of the bill, and they said, this is a senseless way to address this problem. But Bernie was shrewd. He knew he wouldn't pass the Stop Bezos Act. The Stop Bezos Act was designed as a piece of politics to draw attention to the fact that many Amazon workers are on food stamps. And indeed, what happened was Amazon shortly after raised its minimum wage to $15 an hour. Now, they sort of cut benefits elsewhere to sort of fudge it so they didn't lose too much money. But they made this very public thing, and it was in direct response to Bernie. I mean, you could look up the news articles. I mean, Bernie shamed them publicly, and he waved his Stop Bezos Act in the air, and he said, Jeff Bezos should have to pay. And all of the policy people were thinking, well, is that the right policy for addressing inequality? But there was another question that they weren't asking, which is this good politics? And indeed, it was excellent politics.
And I think another aspect of that is the idea that change only comes from the bottom up. You know, you can't tinker at the top and expect that to last. I mean, Obama, I think, toward the end of his administration, he did some very good things by executive order. I guess he got tired of trying to get the Republicans to go along with him. And all those executive orders have been undone by Trump. So tinkering at the top doesn't really work. Talk about the movement building aspects of being a socialist.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, there's a fantastic New Republic article from, I think, 2017 about how Obama dismantled his Organizing for America apparatus. And then when it came time to sort of get people out in the streets, there was nobody to come out in the streets. And what Bernie understands, I mean, he said he's going to be an organizer in chief in office. Well, organizers do not just take power and then say, you know, well, now I'm the president, it's my job to write the good orders. So I'm going to get the best people, they're going to write good executive orders, and then I'm going to sign all those orders. That is not what happens, because if you do that, as you say, the next president will just undo all of your orders. So you've got to think very hard about the political question, which is, how do I avoid having the next president be a monster like Donald Trump? And I think it's very clear that Obama never thought about that, because Trump took Obama completely by surprise. They were shocked. Some people weren't shocked, but they were shocked. And I think, you know, Bernie Sanders wasn't surprised. Michael Moore wasn't surprised. You know, some people had sort of seen it coming. They'd seen a sort of right-wing backlash developing. But what you have to do is you have to get the people on your side, because, for example, you have to have a realistic, credible threat against a senator who won't vote to support your bill, right? You have to know what are you going to do to turn them around? how are you going to get them to flip? And one way is by threatening to run someone in the primary against them if they don't comply. But that's meaningless unless you have a huge team of people where... So if a Bernie Sanders presidency means that Bernie Sanders has an army of volunteers, then it means that that army of volunteers is both a carrot and a stick. Bernie can say to you, look, you come with me on Medicare for All. The army of volunteers is going to swoop into your district, right? They're going to be yours as well. And if you don't, well, it's interesting because we have this wonderful young progressive who's the next AOC, and we have someone who's all ready to run against you. So then you have power. Then you have the actual ability to get people to sign on to your agenda. But unless you have a popular movement behind you, there's nothing you can do. You go into the room and they say, I'm not voting for it. You say, well, please, please vote for it. And they go, no. And you say, well, but it's the right thing to do. And they go, well, I don't care. I don't care that it's the right thing to do. It doesn't work. You have no power. So you have to think very strategically, you know, what actually builds political power.
You mentioned Medicare for All. I was very interested this morning as we're talking to read a piece by Chris Saliza of the Washington Post. He says, you know, what happened to Elizabeth Warren? Right now she has lost ground in the polls. And he says it is because she came out trying to explain her Medicare for All policy. And, you know, people got cold feet. And so her polls went down. What he doesn't seem to put into the same frame, however, is that Bernie Sanders' polls have been going up at the same time. And Bernie wrote the damn bill.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that Elizabeth Warren attempting to explain Medicare for All is what did her in there. I mean, I would explain it as, well, Elizabeth Warren kind of tried to have it both ways, in that she tried to have a plan that would appease more moderate factions of the Democratic Party by promising not to raise taxes. But then also she said she had this very strange two-part structure where she said, you know, the first part is going to be, we're going to do the public option. Then, with you know, years later down the road, we're going to do Medicare for All. And that's just a terrible idea politically, because you've given away, number one, you've given away your whole strategy. And number two, you're taking on two giant tasks rather than one. So and it ended up pleasing nobody. And I think one of the virtues of Bernie Sanders, one of the things he understands that is real good politics, is even if you know that most people don't agree with you on something, if you stick to it and you explain it, you can persuade people. And honesty in your convictions counts for quite a lot. People like Bernie Sanders because they sense that he's not pandering to them. He's not trying to put together a plan that is going to sort of trick them into thinking that their taxes aren't being raised at all, which, you know, the Elizabeth Warren plan, the way she funded it, was kind of this weird attempt to bury a tax increase to say that it wasn't a tax increase. And she wouldn't answer directly the question of whether taxes will go up when she was asked at the debate. But Bernie Sanders did answer it directly. And he said, yes, your taxes will go up, but your premiums are going to go down more than your taxes go up. And that's the whole point. The whole point is to end up with more money in your pocket. And it doesn't matter whether you call it taxes or premiums. What matters is how much money you have at the end of the day. And he explains that in a very clear way to people. And that means that they're more likely to sign on to his policy because they don't feel like it's overly complicated. They don't feel like it's hiding the ball. They don't feel like it's being formulated in a way that is designed to sort of manipulate them. And he's been saying it for decades. So I think that's the kind of thing that is sound politics here.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Nathan Robinson about his new book, Why You Should Be a Socialist, a primer on democratic socialism for those who are extremely skeptical of it. You just wrote a piece that I thought was right on the money, your article in Current Affairs about manufacturing consent in action. It was about how the PBS NewsHour did a long update on all the candidates except Bernie Sanders. So talk about the Bernie blackout, and do you feel that it's a something that will be fatal to his campaign.
Well, it's funny. That was actually, you know, that was last night's PBS NewsHour. My parents called me and they said, we watched the NewsHour and they did all the candidates, but they didn't do Bernie. And I went back and watched it. And I was like, I mean, it was really, really brazen. They talked about Amy Klobuchar. They talked about, you know, and Kamala Harris, whose campaign was doing so badly that she has since dropped out. But no even mention of Bernie Sanders across a long segment. So Bernie's supporters have been complaining for a long time that this is not isolated, that this happens quite a bit, that the media elevates less radical candidates. And I think it was worth sort of exploring how this NewsHour segment in particular framed the campaign, because it really did show that this does happen. You know, we know from 2016 that Bernie Sanders got a lot less media coverage than Hillary Clinton. But in this campaign, there are many more candidates that they can focus on that are allowing them to sort of avoid discussing Bernie. I mean, I can't speculate as to whether it's going to be fatal to his campaign, because I don't know. I mean, he's leading the recent polls in New Hampshire and he's number two in Iowa. So he's doing quite well in spite of this. But it does make it incredibly difficult to get any traction when no one will cover you. So much of what people know is filtered through the information channels that they see. So if they just don't see you, they're never going to know about you. So even if you were the candidate they would have preferred if they had learned more about you, they're never going to have that opportunity. Now, fortunately, Bernie is very well funded, so he can buy ads now. He can use money in politics to make up for this lack of media coverage. But it certainly means that his campaign is struggling against this additional hurdle.
So we've been talking a lot about Bernie, who is an example of the Democratic Socialist, but really this movement is not only much bigger than him, it also predates him. The DSA has been around, Democratic Socialists of America have been around for a long time. You also point to Occupy, and I think correctly so, as the beginning of this movement. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, Occupy was kind of a formative experience for me because it was a remarkable political moment, because it was in many ways a protest against Barack Obama, because it was a protest of profound disillusionment, mostly by young people, with politics. I mean, the Occupy encampment, the tactic of setting up a campsite and refusing to leave. The reason that that happened was because people felt that there was nothing else they could do. They felt that elected officials weren't looking out for them. And that's interesting in the era of the Obama presidency, that all of the occupiers felt that the presidency wouldn't help them. They were looking around and people that they knew were losing their houses and, you know, had really no chance of building up retirement savings, forget having kids, you know, that's impossible. And the protest itself was not, you know, as a tactic, it didn't work in that there were no demands. You know, the old Frederick Douglass quote about power concedes nothing without a demand. And there were big debates about whether they should have a demand. And ultimately, they were kicked out of the park and they didn't really get anything other than sort of seeping into the public consciousness, this sense of the United 99%. But it's a really crucial moment because it's a popular uprising. It's a left economic popular uprising. And it's a very authentic popular uprising. It's not astroturfing. It's not organized. It wasn't organized by anyone, really. It was very spontaneous. And I think there are so many lessons we can learn from that. I mean, one, the big important lesson is you have to have some kind of theory of how you're going to take power. Now, I understand why they didn't, because they felt so disillusioned that they thought there was nothing you could do. But they were very, very skeptical of running candidates in elections. And socialists today, in this kind of continuation of that movement are much less skeptical. In fact, one of the big focuses is who can we get into office? How do we get people into office? How do we get our people in power instead of their people? And in a way, again, it's not really Occupy's fault because this was pre-Bernie, so no one thought you could do it. I mean, when Bernie started the race, he was polling at about 5%. I mean, he had no support when he began, and it was in many ways his 2016 candidacy that proved the viability of electoral politics for leftists. And then they sort of went, oh, we need to take this seriously. Maybe we could actually win. But Occupy was this kind of like, we don't know what else to do, so we're going to set up camp and refuse to leave. We're planting our flag. This is our statement. And it was a really important statement. It was in many ways a very beautiful thing because I went to a couple of the Occupy encampments, and they were really sort of amazing little micro communities where people took care of each other and people had, you know, arguments, I mean, like comradely arguments late into the night, the kind of arguments you want, you know, the real discussions about substantive things, and people were united on something, and it just felt amazing. So yeah, it was a very powerful movement and a real interesting precursor.
Yes, and if I may use a socialist term, there was a kind of dialectical relationship between that Occupy popular movement, I mean the 99%, that was such a powerful slogan, and electoral politics that now has rebounded again after the 2016 election with the movements of teacher strikes in West Virginia, Nevada, in Oklahoma, you know, very much inspired, well, first of all, organized originally by people from the Democratic Socialists of America, many of them, but that really became popular movements. So this is a great example of how it's neither one nor the other, that one has to work on all fronts and in something that you call the big tent.
Yeah, that's how the Democratic Socialists of America describe themselves. They say they're a big tent organization. And one of the things they're trying to do is overcome the previous rifts that often divided the left. I mean, one thing that the history of socialism should teach us is that intra-left conflict can be very, very destructive, to the point where the fact that the Social Democrats and the communists in pre-Nazi Germany couldn't resolve their differences and form a united front, you know, is one of the reasons that the Nazis were able to take power. I mean, it's very, very dangerous if the left can't hold itself together. And historically, socialists have often hated other socialists more than they hate, you know, capitalism. I mean, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, right? The Mensheviks were scum. Well, the Mensheviks were socialists too. And you see this in the United States Socialist Party too. And in some ways, it's understandable that there are those conflicts because there are irresolvable tensions in socialism between reformist and revolutionary socialism, between centralized state-based socialism and decentralized anarchist socialism. It's very hard to resolve those because they're kind of fundamental. But at the same time, if we don't resolve those, if we don't find a way to navigate a middle path, we're going to see what many left organizations historically and many left movements have seen, which is a left that just tears itself to pieces.
And I think you give a clue on something that we already spoke a bit about, and that is in the difference between democratic socialism and social democracy. And I think of the principle that I learned way back about organizing is that you start with small victories, but you always think of the goal. How is this victory, this small victory, going to advance the larger cause? And it really is the basis for making the kinds of coalitions and big tent that you speak about.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, and that's the pragmatic utopianism, is this mixture of long-term and short-term, big and small, things that you need a centralized source of power for, right? Things like stopping climate change that is going to require massive state action, and then things that are, you know, more localized, and we want sort of more decentralization, more focus on, you know, what community choice. So these are debates that have been had for a long time And I think there are ways to have compromises that don't compromise your ultimate values. I mean, many leftists are suspicious of compromise because they associate compromise with capitulation, and they are right to associate it with capitulation because so often it is. But when compromise just means accepting something temporarily because you have to in order to avoid a worse outcome, there's nothing wrong with it so long as you don't end up seeing the compromise as the goal.
Well, Nathan Robinson, it's been a delight to speak with you. Your book is absolutely terrific, Why You Should Be a Socialist. And we also have, you know, there's much in this book that we have not covered. Nathan Robinson, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for those very nice words.
Are you willing to fight for that person who you don't even know as much as you're willing to fight for yourself? Are you willing to stand together and fight for those people who are struggling economically in this country? Are you willing to fight for young people drowning in student debt, even if you are not? Are you willing to fight to ensure that every American has health care as a human right, even if you have good health care?
That was Bernie Sanders speaking at the massive rally he held in Queens in October 2019.
How high's the water, mama? 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 2 feet high and rising. Well, we can make it to the road in a homemade boat, 'cause that's the only thing we got left that'll float. It's already over all the wheat and oats. 2 feet high and rising.
Last week's UN climate conference ended in failure to make any progress on tackling the most dire threat facing our world. Led by the U.S., obstructionist regimes in the service of the fossil fuel industries ensured that our future, both in the short and long term, will be filled with the fires, floods, crop failures, disease epidemics, collapse of our fishing industries and ecosystems, wars and refugee crises caused by the climate catastrophe. So who are you going to call when local emergency infrastructure goes up in flames or underwater? When FEMA runs out of resources to respond to the nth disaster in months? Probably the U.S. Armed Forces, says my next guest, Michael Clare. We spoke with him last week about his recent piece in The Nation magazine, When the Climate Replaces Our Forever Wars, What Will the Military Look Like in Climate Crisis Mode? Well, Michael Clare, thanks so much for coming on to the show again. It's great to have you. We're calling you up because this is a week when another climate summit is happening, this time in Madrid. And you have written a piece for The Nation called When the Climate Replaces Our Forever Wars. This piece is partially speculative, a look back from 2032 with a meeting of the top uniformed officers of the combined armed forces. Why are they meeting?
They meet every year at the beginning of the year to talk about the posture, that's their word, the posture of the armed forces, meaning what is their readiness to engage in combat or other activities, what are the threats, and what is their preparedness to address those threats. They appear typically before the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee, where senior members of Congress question them about that issue. So it's the one time of the year where they come before Congress and they're questioned about their readiness for whatever threats they may face in the year ahead.
So how have the armed services changed in 2032, in a time of climate catastrophe, and we're talking only 12 years into the future?
Well, this is my speculation about how things are going to change, but it's my firm belief that increasingly in the future, the task of the U.S. military will shift from defending against conventional adversaries, conventional threats, like, say, Russia and China, to unconventional threats, primarily those driven by climate change. And those unconventional threats would include humanitarian catastrophes around the world, intense storms and floods, severe droughts that create collapse of states worldwide, mass migrations, pandemics, and the like, on one hand, and at the same time, intense disasters in the United States itself, multiple hurricanes striking the United States, wildfires springing up all over the west coast of the United States, floods in the middle of the U.S. from intense rainfalls, all these things happening simultaneously and forcing the military to attend to these kind of disasters, diverting their forces from traditional enemies to dealing with these climate disasters.
Could one say that that's the upside of climate chaos?
Well, you could look at it how you might. I think from the military's point of view, this is a diversion from what they see as their historic task of defending against foreign enemies. But by this time, I think, looking in the future, the climate threat is going to be so immense that the American public and Congress is going to demand that the military address those threats. And really, who else are you going to turn to? Who are you going to turn to when three hurricanes strike the United States in a row, causing massive collapse of infrastructure and mass panic, hospitals shutting down, no power, roads and airports closed? Who are you going to turn to? Local authorities will do the best they can. FEMA will step in. But there is nobody else to turn to but the military to address large-scale disasters on that scale.
I remember during Hurricane Katrina that was it the National Guard that went into there? And it was kind of scary because what happens to civil liberties? What happens to human rights when the military comes in?
This is a big issue. There are laws that constrain what the military can do. It ordinarily cannot make arrests on U.S. soil. That's the Posse Comitatus Act that prevents them from doing that. So they usually leave things to the police and the National Guard to perform those civil functions. I'm talking about the active duty military. The National Guard normally is under state control. But in the kind of large-scale disasters that we're talking about, like Katrina, local authorities collapsed, or they deserted their posts, or they behaved in an unethical manner, protecting some parts of the city and not others, abandoning large parts of New Orleans to people's own devices, leading to large-scale death and other catastrophes. So you can't trust necessarily local authorities to perform their legal obligations. And in that case, then who's going to be able to perform those functions? Now, mind you, having spoken to people in the military, this is not what they want to do. They've been trained to fight wars in Asia and in Europe and the Middle East. That's what they're trained to do. They don't want to come in and perform a police function in the United States. Yet, I think climate change changes everything, as Naomi Klein says, and it's going to alter the role of the military.
Are they getting prepared for this?
Not really. Now, bear in mind that the commander-in-chief, President Trump, says that climate change is a hoax. He says, I don't want to hear about this. And I don't want the government to do anything about it. So it's very difficult for the military to act around this issue. Nonetheless, they are taking steps to address climate change. One of their problems is that their own bases are just as vulnerable to climate change as are American communities, especially the Navy, because naval bases have to be on the ocean, which means their bases are pretty much at sea level. So they're a lot like places like Miami and Charleston, South Carolina, and New York City, for that matter. They're very close to the sea and therefore vulnerable to rising oceans and to extreme hurricanes and the like. So this is one area where the military is very conscious that their ability to carry out their functions in the future is at severe risk. And they are taking steps now to bolster the defenses of their coastal facilities.
What do you feel civil society needs to do to avoid the dangers to democracy of privileging, you know, of this kind of interference and intervention, which will be necessary in the case of disasters, you know, from really taking over the politics and eroding whatever democracy we may have left? What can we do?
I've written about this. I have a book out called All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change, where I address some of these issues. And you know, there's no alternative except to slow the pace of climate change. You know, we all have to understand that climate change is happening at a much faster rate than anyone anticipated even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. And we have to appreciate just how devastating it's going to be for the United States of America, like every other country. And unless we take steps now to rapidly reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, we're going to face intense disasters in the years to come, no question about it. And the only way to deal with those disasters is for every community in America, every city, to immediately establish a climate change emergency preparedness organization in the city and to develop what kind of plans they're going to make to address these dangers. If you're on a coastline, that's going to mean building seawalls and moving houses and businesses that are right on the coast, moving critical facilities from ground levels to higher levels in buildings, protecting critical infrastructure and the like. Every city has to start doing that. Otherwise, when these disasters strike, cities are going to be immobilized and some will have to be abandoned entirely. So if you're concerned about protecting a civil society in the future, you must take steps now to protect your cities and communities.
Well, Michael Clare, that is a sobering prediction that you have, and a very urgent remedy for us to follow. Your article in The Nation is When the Climate Replaces Our Forever Wars. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
My pleasure as always.
Michael Clare. He's out with a new book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. We'll be talking with him about that book in January. Like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Find the link at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.